Hey, welcome back to our three-part series on Porsche. This is part three, the final chapter. We're talking everything from the 930 Turbo to the new Taycan. So a pretty wide breadth of time. We're seeing Porsche get handed off from the Porsche family to outsiders in the auto industry, and then where they go from there. They went through some dicey times to a Porsche that is just thriving. All right, let's get into it. In the early 90s, Porsche was on the edge of a financial disaster, and nothing seemed to be able to stop the bleeding. Just a few years earlier, they were going beat for beat with Ferrari and Roof to make the fastest sports car in the world. Now, it looked like they wouldn't be making cars for much longer. In hindsight, it's hard to believe what seemed like a golden era on the outside was filled with so much chaos and uncertainty. Changes had to be made, and drastic ones at that. The solutions they devised could have alienated their entire fan base, and for a lot of purists, they did. But the story of Porsche is one of adapting and innovating. They've succeeded with ideas deemed impossible or ridiculous, and invented entire segments. And yet somehow today, we see Porsche as an automaker grounded in tradition and history, a take that is true in so many ways. How can a company rooted in tradition drive so much change? Why did making the best cars of their time nearly tank the company? And how did Porsche defy expectations and define an industry? Today on Pass Gas, it's the finale of our three-part series on Porsche. Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Across from me today, Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you. And to my left, Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? This is episode 299. We're on the verge of history.
Joe's getting juiced.
That's right. This is episode 299, so close to 300. But today, yes.
It's one away.
One away, yeah.
It's almost like one away.
Yeah. We are almost one away from 300. Yeah, but here is the conclusion of our story, our saga on Porsche.
Yeah.
It's been a tumultuous run, I think.
Lots of ups and downs.
It's interesting to note that, like, sports cars and hypercars and supercar companies have always been on the verge of bankruptcy, and it's such a money pit to develop these kind of cars, especially if you're making technology that has never existed before. And Porsche is not immune to that. They seem like a really stable company, at least for the last 25 years, but that is because of something that wasn't really a sports car. We'll get into it, but
I have an idea what it is.
I have an update on the thumbs down shifting.
Oh yes. Some business. Yes.
So you explained to me the purpose of shifting with your thumb down.
Yes.
A supinated motion with your radius and ulna. And I at first it was very awkward, but I actually really love it for like third and fifth now. So I am a convert.
There you go.
I'm a pretentious shifter now.
It's not that pretentious. It kind of looks like, I would say pretentious would be like a using just up. the tips of your fingers and just whoop and whoop.
Yeah. Yes. Claw.
The claw. Yeah.
I started doing that after you were like, man, you're really thrashing on the sim shifter.
Yeah.
But that was out of, like, this is not mine. I don't really care if this breaks.
Yeah, well, I care about it because we've had to replace it three times now. The shifter.
I like the idea of a sim shifter that's, like, missing gears.
Yeah, it would, Bart, because this guy over here would be abusing the equipment. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you've adapted. I'm glad you see the utility.
Yeah.
You've been driving the 3 Series like that?
I've been driving my Beamer because my Audi was in the shop. But
what kind of gloves are you using?
Do
they have the holes in the knuckles?
They're Ferrari gloves, and they're missing the pinky.
Ooh.
The pinky is bare.
So you can still do coke.
Sweet, that's cool. All right, well.
Oh, I also went to a sit down Pizza Hut.
Okay.
I drove there if that's okay, a good transition.
Sure.
But I didn't know they existed anymore. I went to a sit down Pizza Hut. As someone who hasn't had Pizza Hut in forever, I prefer it to Domino's and Little Caesars. The sauce is really
sweet.
What
did you get? Did you do their deep dish? You
know, no, I was.
I forget what they call it. The pan pizza.
I was pushing for the New York style because it's the only one you can get in 16 size. Everything else is 14 and 12. But the pan, the personal pan is great. That's one of my favorites. But we just got the normal one. And the dough is really airy, which I like. Because, you know, like you could reheat it and the next day it's going to be pretty good. The sauce is really sweet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I haven't been to a Pizza Hut in a couple of years. The last one I went to was out in Wendover, Nevada.
Yeah.
Near Bonneville.
My only criticism is that they really sterilized the indoor. You know, you used to have like stained glass lamps.
Yeah.
Red vinyl booths and the buffet.
They don't do that
check
anymore?
Check a red pattern on
they
the
don't
tables.
Do
the...
I think they're going for like a Starbucks meets a sports
I'm
bar
so
now.
I'm so over that like kind of design.
Yeah. Everything's gray like that. And like dull vinyl floor. And then there's just like 8 TVs that were playing. Like they want you to go watch baseball there, which is like, they don't even sell beer at this one. Why would you do that?
It's fair.
So
that's the whole point of a sit down pizza.
Yeah, I want to get drunk in public. watching the Dodgers.
I want to like get my grubby hands under that decorative kale.
All right. Well, I've already learned so much, but I think we need to learn some more. Let's get into it. Our finale of the Porsche story. Here we go. So we left off on a high but uncertain note in Porsche's history. In the early 1970s, they were dominating the world of racing with win after win in everything from touring cars to rally, and had even won the 24 Hours of Le Mans 2 years in a row. The 911, which was barely 10 years old at that point, was on top of the sports car food chain thanks to its reputation for precision, performance, and reliability. But Porsche was also beginning a new chapter without the Porsche family at the helm. In 1972, Ferry Porsche, son of company founder Ferdinand Porsche, initiated a restructuring of management that aimed to get the family out of business operations.
I'm getting too old for this crap.
Yeah, basically. The company had grown larger than he might have ever dreamed possible. Porsche wasn't just a small volume sports car maker or a bespoke race car builder now, but a fully fledged car manufacturer. Ferry saw the Porsches as a family of engineers, not C-suite executives, and thought the best move for the company was to keep the Porsches in major engineering roles, but to bring in auto industry experts to control the company's finances.
What could possibly go wrong?
And so Ferry stepped into the role of chairman. His son, 911 designer Butzi Porsche, and his nephew, head of Porsche Racing, Ferdinand Piech, retained their engineering roles, but lost their final authority in company decision-making.
That's kind of something that wouldn't happen nowadays, where you would just, like, I feel like mostly when it's nepotism happening within a company, it's like they're just padding the board of directors, like giving them the sons and the nephews and the daughters, just kind of these cushy jobs where it doesn't really matter what they say, like they're just getting the paycheck. This is like the opposite of that, where it's like, we need to protect our engineering, and the only people we trust is our family.
That's interesting. At the time, it seemed like a big risk for Ferry to entrust the Porsche brand to a bunch of outsiders. They had proven very capable at designing cars people wanted to buy and built an internationally respected brand. The auto world and Porsche fans were nervous. If the Porsches could take it this far, why couldn't they take it further? And what would bottom-line protecting accountants do to these cars known for their high quality? Porsche's new management was about to introduce big changes. But in a twist no one expected...
It's a twist!
They didn't want to cheapen the build quality or sacrifice performance. Instead, they wanted to make Porsches faster.
That's a Shyamalanian twist right there.
Yeah.
Also, around this time, I think at around the 10-year mark is when they started thinking that the 911 was going to be out of date soon, which is funny to think about, which is why they started doing like the 914, the 944, and the 928. But it's funny to think that like they thought the 911 was at the end of its run by then.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
In the early 1970s, Porsches weren't known for their outright speed. They were designed to be strong all-rounders, Quick but comfortable, nimble but practical, innovative but reliable. If you wanted a daily driver sports car that was just as at home on the track as it was on the road, you bought a Porsche. If you wanted something scary fast, you looked elsewhere. The timing of the new management to pursue a faster and powerful 911 seemed odd at first. The oil crisis seemingly worsened by the day, and inflation was soaring, making an already expensive car even more expensive and even worse on fuel economy seemed like a recipe for disaster. But as we'll see, in an era defined by shrinking engine sizes, boring cars, and the general brown paint malaise of the oil crisis, Porsche defied gravity.
Porsche does have some good browns, though.
I'm thinking of, yeah, that, like, that mid-late 70s one that is just like a brown.
There's like a dark kind of metallic chocolate looking one, and then there's like a penny copper one that's
good. It's more like a root beer. picture in your mind the effervescence of a root beer with the sun coming through.
Buffalo Bill would be a Porsche purist.
Think of a brown, and then more brown than that.
It is brown of the brown. Like, it's brown of the brown.
They hired the best brown experts in Europe to come together and make the best brown in the world.
Porsche wanted to stop building prototype race cars and go all in on racing the 911, which meant they needed a certain number of production cars in near-race trim to meet homologation regulations. The ace up Porsche's sleeve was the turbocharger. Turbos had extensive use on piston engine-powered aircraft beginning in World War I, but the technology really came into its own during World War II.
I didn't even realize it was that early. Okay. World War I? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They called it turbo normalizing.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because it was at elevation, so you'd use a turbo to normalize the air pressure for the engine.
In a lot of cases, too, like planes that were, because they didn't have like ECUs or anything like that, they could adjust the fuel on the fly. A lot of the planes had to get to a certain altitude. Like the planes were designed to fly at a certain altitude, and that's where you were expected to like engage targets and stuff. Otherwise, if you went below that, where the air was like denser, so you'd be running fatter, your performance wouldn't be as great. There's a really great Real Engineering as a video they just put out on the P-38 Lightning, which is like one of my favorite planes. I hope I got the name right. The P-38, anyway, it has like the twin tail booms and stuff, but it had a supercharger and turbocharger.
It was twin charged?
Twin charged. The intercooler was inside the wings, these huge intercoolers along the edge of the wing. Like all this stuff I had no idea about. It's so sick. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, back to World War II. Though high-tech aircraft engineering moved on to jet engines shortly after the war, lower-cost piston engine aircraft continued to refine turbo technology. It seemed only natural that they'd make their way into cars, but as of the early 70s, it had struggled to do so. General Motors had tried and failed with the Chevy Corvair Monza and Oldsmobile Jetfire in the early 60s. In the late 60s, turbos began popping up in racing, and even powered Bobby Unser to win the 1968 Indy 500. But for road cars, they were seen as too complicated, too unreliable, and prohibitively expensive to fix when they inevitably broke.
I think the Bobby Unser one was maybe an Offey engine?
That sounds correct.
Because DFV, the X, DFX, wasn't a thing until I think the early 70s. Turbocharged DFV.
You love that DFV.
I love it, dude. Dude, they're so hard to find. They're all clapped out.
Porsche, however, saw the turbocharger's potential and began working on a turbo 911 concept. To ensure reliability, Porsche implemented the use of a first-of-its-kind boost controller to limit the stress placed on the turbocharger. And according to Luke Smith in The History of Porsche, the company took, quote, the rigid wheel hubs from the 917 and the kinematics of the front and rear axles from the 911 Carrera RSR to handle the power delivery. In testing, the 911 turbo revealed that despite its safeguards, it still had a racing pedigree. It could reach 60 miles per hour from a standstill in just 5.3 seconds. Again, this is in the 70s.
So much torque, it twists the frame.
And could hit a top speed of 155 miles an hour. These figures and the unproven technology stretched the idea of what was even possible at the time. Porsche was sure they had something special on their hands, but this street-adapted racing technology came at a potentially hazardous cost, turbo lag. Modern turbos can spool up almost immediately, but early turbochargers needed several seconds at full throttle to kick in. And when they did, there was a massive surge in power. It's an addictive sensation in a straight line, but to inexperienced drivers, it can be deadly when the wheel is turned. Porsche pressed on with their gamble. They unveiled the 930 911 turbo concept in September 1973 at the Frankfurt International Motor Show, and it was released to the public a year later as the 911 Turbo 3.0. The 930 was an instant classic thanks to its cutting-edge technology, high performance, and distinctive appearance, thanks to the addition of the whale tail spoiler.
I love this, Jen.
Yeah, they're sick.
I don't think I'd ever get one just because...
They're like $1 million.
Well, the next one is so good, too. They are $1 million, too. Yeah, either my old neighbor spent like 10 years rebuilding.
You mean a, like former neighbor, or is this just an old dude you live
with? Former neighbor. Okay. He's about my age, but he spent about 10 years like rebuilding an old 930.
That's sick.
It wasn't even that good. It just kind of looked like, you know, he had gone to the scrapyard and got some stuff. But he was asking, he was like, I think it's time I sell my 930, and he wanted $40,000 for it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's crazy. What are you smoking?
The 911 Turbo was so tail happy and powerful, in fact, it became known as the Widowmaker. Its engine made a massive 260 horsepower, and the car was feather light at 2,635 pounds.
How many Nolans is that?
A little over 10. It had no ABS or power steering. Its rear biased weight meant it was more prone to snap oversteer. And thanks to the on-off power delivery that broke the tires loose the moment the boost began to build, controlling a slide with the throttle was next to impossible. This made the car very tricky to drive, and it led to a lot of accidents.
Yeah, there's a reason that people don't really drift Porsches. I mean, Chelsea Denofa?
Chelsea Denofa is building he has a Cayman that he's built into a drift car. Adam, Shop Daddy Adam, is building a...
He's got a 911 though, right?
I think so.
Because the Cayman is rear mid-engine, so it's a little bit more balanced. But, yeah, it's hard to drift a 911.
Yeah. Since this first generation, the Turbo has become perhaps the most sought-after 911 trim. There are faster and more hardcore versions like the GT RS2 and RS3, but the Turbo manages to strike the perfect balance between race-ready performance and daily drivability that Bootsy sought from the 911 from the very beginning.
That's got to be a nickname, right?
That's if you keep naming kids your own name, you're going to have to start using nicknames.
Yeah, his name is Ferdinand Alexander Porsche. But let's see his nickname.
He could be Fappy.
Fappy.
Because of his initials.
Yeah. Fappy Porsche.
Well, that's redundant. You can't. Ferdinand Alexander Porsche. Porsche. It's just Fappy.
Yo, what up, Fap? How you doing, dude?
Don't shake me down, Fap.
Don't shake my hand.
Okay. There's a Kleenex stuck to it.
Okay.
All right. Done with that bit. Done and dusted.
We crushed it. The 911 Turbo's power continued to increase to the end of the 70s, and the handling got more and more treacherous. By the early 80s, Porsche knew they could only go so far with their current platform before a change needed to be made. But Porsche, for all their innovations, are traditionalists. And despite the obvious route to fixing the 911's sketchy handling being abandoning the rear engine layout, they weren't going to do that. Instead, Porsche decided to develop an all-wheel drive system. Early into the all-wheel drive design process, Porsche recognized that the 911 was too precious for their brand and their bottom line to be used as a test mule for an unproven technology. Instead, they thought it'd be better to build a new car around an all-wheel drive system, throw every high-tech concept they had at it, and run it through the gauntlet that was Group B rally racing to test it. The project directly led to the 959. Porsche began with a 911 platform and a 2.8-liter twin-turbo flat-six based on the engines found in their wildly successful 956 and 962 race cars. Soon, the body and all-wheel drive system began to take shape around them. But early on, Porsche realized that while all-wheel drive could solve some of the drivability issues, smoothing out the power delivery would go even further. As we mentioned earlier, early turbocharged cars had a jarring on-off power delivery that was brought on by massive turbo lag. If they were going to develop and test a solution, the 959 project was the time to do it. Porsche's solution was a sequential turbo system. Unlike the standard twin turbo setup, in which the turbos operate identically throughout the rev range, a sequential turbo system allows two turbochargers to work independently of one another. At low revs, exhaust gas is only fed through one smaller turbo.
A little baby turbo.
This means boost is built earlier and in a more linear fashion. As revs climb and the exhaust flow becomes too much for the first turbo to handle, a handoff occurs where the gases are fed to the second and larger turbocharger.
Big daddy turbo.
An ingenious solution that created a much smoother power delivery across the rev range. That's smart.
What is bi-turbo then? Is that sequential?
So
bi-turbo usually refers to two turbos of the same size, both feeding the engine.
So that's just twin turbo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the German it's a German name for.
Yeah. And there's some turbos or twin turbo systems where I think Alfa Romeo or some Italian company did this where like on one side of the turbo, one turbocharger feeds like the opposite
bank
of engines.
That's
yeah.
Crossing the V.
What's the point of that?
It helped equalize.
Because they had trouble. If one turbo is closer to one bank, because it has to do with cylinder timing, et cetera, yeah. That when they shoot it to the other side, it means your exhaust from one side is boosting
yes.
the other instead of exhaust from one side boosting its own side.
Okay.
So then which would help normalize the pressure in the cylinders.
Gotcha.
Otherwise, one could run away. It was the thought.
Dude, I watch every like 6 months, I'll watch a turbo diesel runaway video. And people just stuff rags and then it's like, oh, that could have been bad.
When the 959 team finished the car in 1987, they had a truly revolutionary design. Not only was it the first production car with sequential turbos, but its all-wheel drive system had advanced electronically controlled torque vectoring that could send up to 80% of the power to the rear wheels. It also had hollow magnesium wheels with built-in tire pressure monitors and automatic ride height adjustment to give it an aerodynamic boost. This was 1987.
That's crazy.
Its performance specs were equally impressive and still are, even in a modern context. With 443 horsepower on tap, the 959 could go from 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds and had a top speed of 197 miles an hour.
That's almost as fast as a Grand National.
And that's not even the big flat six back then. That was a 2.8 liter. They had already come out with a 3 liter.
That 197 miles an hour made it the fastest production car in the world when it launched. The automotive press was in awe of the 959, and Car and Driver summed it up best, quote, "We hesitate to call any car perfect, but we have finally had a chance to drive a Porsche 959 on the street, and the word perfect is difficult to avoid. What single word more accurately describes a car that combines race car performance with luxury sedan comfort, that is equally adept in commuting through rush hour traffic, and profiling in jet-set locales, negotiating blizzard-swept mountain passes, and outrunning light airplanes. The Porsche 959 can accomplish almost any automotive mission so well that to call it perfect is the mildest of overstatements."
Wow. In our Gordon Murray episode, this is kind of telling of how good this car was. In our Gordon Murray episode, he took, when he was developing the F1, the McLaren F1, he took all the best supercars of the time. He took the 959, the Bugatti EB110, the Ferrari F40, and he was like tearing apart the other cars. The only criticism he had about the 959 was that the interior was too much like a normal 911. Like, that's the only thing he could really like split hairs about.
Unfortunately, though, this performance came at a price. In 1987, the MSRP of the 959 was around $225,000, which is about $637 today's money. $637,000, not $637.
Got it.
And much like the Type 360 GP car that Ferry Porsche designed for Piero Duccio, the 959 would never race in the series it was designed for. Group B Rally proved to be too fast and dangerous and was canceled before the 959's launch. It didn't stop Porsche from rallying it, though, and the 959 took first and second place in the 1986 Paris-Dakar Rally.
I love this car. We shot it for a bumper-to-bumper a while ago.
That was a long time ago now.
And it was Just so cool. I would love to drive it.
That was sick. In hindsight, it's hard to believe that such a revolutionary and impressive car like the 959 was conceived as a test mule. In the end, only 292 were built by the time production ended in 1993. It was also insanely expensive to develop, so much so that despite the massive price tag, Porsche lost money on every single 959 it sold. Even so, the car's technological legacy can't be denied, and the 959 ultimately did serve its purpose of testing and perfecting future technology for the 911. In 1988, a 959-based all-wheel drive system made its way into the 964 Carrera 4, making it the first 911 to feature all-wheel drive. Shortly after, in 1991, all-wheel drive became standard on the 911 Turbo. The 959's sequential turbo technology found its way into the 993 generation in 1995, 993 is my favorite, and made the 993 Turbo the pinnacle of mid-90s supercars.
The 993 is so good looking. I also didn't know that like all turbos were all-wheel drive.
Everything since 91, all of those.
I wondered just because like the 930 was so deadly that they were like, let's just make it all-wheel drive, make it a little bit safer.
And since 1995, both all-wheel drive and sequential turbocharging have become defining characteristics of the 911 Turbo. Very cool. Dude, I love the 930 so much. It's sick. I just love that horizontal rear tail light. Mm-hmm. So cool.
What if you took a 911 993 gen nose and put it on your Ram?
That would be interesting. I'll think about that, Joe. Thank you. Yeah.
I think it might work, actually.
Okay.
Pretty sure, like 4 bolts or something.
Yeah.
I saw it on Reddit.
Okay.
It's like 1-to-1.
I trust you. Thank you.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Unfortunately, Porsche didn't exactly get big returns on their massive investment into the 959's supercar technology when the tech finally trickled down into the 911. And while there may never be a good time to lose money as a business, Porsche's new leadership, the same leadership that was installed to make better financial decisions than the Porsche family, picked a terrible time to lose money. According to Road and Track, Porsche sales dropped from 50,000 units in 1986 to just 14,000 by 1993. Slipping sales in the U.S. market, which accounted for nearly 50% of Porsche's global sales, had a huge impact. Signs of things to come were prevalent in the early 80s, and Porsche responded by updating their, quote, affordable segment offering, the 928 and 944. This move helped, but profit margins were growing thinner by the year.
It's kind of weird that their V8 option was considered the affordable option.
Yeah. By the early 1990s, the company was nearing bankruptcy. Toyota even swooped in and tried to buy Porsche. Thankfully, the Porsche family, who still owned the company, refused. And by 1993, a new CEO named Wendelin Wedeking was promoted from head of production to lead Porsche through this crisis. If Porsche wouldn't sell to the Japanese, Wedeking thought, they still had a lot to learn from them. He hired ex-Toyota engineers to advise them on new manufacturing processes, and soon, Japanese consultants swarmed the factory in Stuttgart.
Do you think he tricked them and was like, yeah, we're considering letting you buy us. Why don't you come into our factory and tell us what we're doing wrong?
Just what would you do?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sounds like he just hired some consultants. In fact, the consultants were shocked to find Porsche still ran things like a tiny workshop.
Grow up, Joe.
Yeah, this is a serious show, dude.
They're business people.
Come on, Wendelin Wedeking doesn't sound like a little troll to you? Yeah. Like an underbridge troll?
He sounds like he works at the Keebler factory.
That's who they should have brought in for efficiencies.
Yeah.
The Keebler elves.
First step, make your factory a big tree.
The consultants were shocked to find that Porsche still ran things like a tiny workshop with the volume of cars they were now producing. The New York Times notes that the consultants were stunned by the inefficiency and noted engineers had to, quote, had to sift through parts bins and climb ladders to search shelves for the right parts to build a single car.
It's just how we've always done it.
Between the proud Stuttgart workers and Wedeking and his consultants, Wedeking, sorry, the workers The Werkers.
The Werkers under Wedeking.
The Werkers under Wedeking prided themselves on their methodical processes and believed no one could argue with their results. The changes the consultants were suggesting be made, which dramatically sped up the process and introduced more of an assembly line approach than a bespoke build, saw these changes as antithetical to cars they made and what they stood for.
They both have points, but like you gotta modernize at some point.
Yeah. Wedeking realized that if they didn't change their slow and methodical approach to car making, there would be no more company to make cars for. He refused to budge an inch on worker demands.
I'm still surprised that they were able to make 55,000 cars this way.
It is crazy. Legend has it that one day, following an argument with some of the Stuttgart employees, that Wedeking walked onto the factory floor with an angle grinder and destroyed all the shelving the workers used for spare parts to drive home the point that the new manufacturing processes didn't require backup inventory. German publication Der Spiegel even claims that when a manager refused to cooperate, Wedeking threatened to, quote, cut off his balls.
Wow. And he held up the angle grinder to drive home the point.
I don't even want to imagine that.
Ow. Yeah, I got something to say.
Can I talk to my HR rep, please?
But for all of Wedeking's faults, he was determined to keep Porsche, Porsche. He even refused to entertain any mergers or buyouts, saying, quote, if size were the decisive criterion to success, the dinosaurs would still be alive.
Good point, Wedeking. I love how they were for decades doing shit the same way that you would just do in your own garage.
Yeah, basically.
Where's that? Oh, I got an alternator somewhere. Yeah, just where did I put that?
Scrounging around in the back. Yeah.
Climb the ladder.
Oh, I'm going to need that exhaust someday.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. It's again. Don't worry. It's against the wall. It's not anybody's way.
I saw an Instagram video that was like the moment all dads are waiting for and they're like fixing this bed. Yeah. He's like, man, if we just had like a 10-inch long 2x4 that had another piece of board that like nailed to it like this, like that would really fix it. And then the dad like runs downstairs and he's like.
Digs in a box.
And yeah. That's pretty fun.
Now, how's your lumber collection coming, Joe?
I've stopped doing woodworking because I don't have any space for my circular saw, and so it's just been kind of rotting outside. And I'm scared that it's gonna fly off when it's
shattered.
Yeah.
But I've been working on my car. I put a
on the Datsun.
Yeah, cold air intake on. Nice. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I found a fan shroud. Nice. And I did that, so now I can idle in traffic not be scared.
That's good. That's great.
So eventually, I'm gonna drive it here when one of these bays in the garage is open. Nice. I'll put the new exhaust on and the steering wheel.
Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah.
So through the late 90s and early 2000s, it seemed like Porsche had lost its mind. Things were off to a mild start when in 1997, Porsche launched a new entry-level car called the Boxster. The Boxster concept was introduced at the Detroit Motor Show the same year Wedeking took over as CEO, and it looked strikingly similar to what hit the road in 1997. As with the 928 and 944, the Boxster was designed to be an entry-level Porsche and to appeal to younger buyers. Like its predecessors, it still had a stigma to overcome. It wasn't seen as a car you aspired to own, but rather something you bought because you couldn't afford the 911. But the Boxster was able to succeed where the 928 and 944 couldn't, thanks to a few new key elements of the design. It was designed to be a roadster, and it was mid-engined. The Roadster was having a bit of a comeback in the 90s thanks to the Mazda Miata and the BMW Z3. During Porsche's development of the Boxster, the Miata was a constant reference point. It had to be accessible and easy to drive, but it also couldn't compete directly with the Miata. It had to be a Porsche. The Boxster started off with a modest 204 horsepower, 2.5-liter flat-six capable of a 7-second sprint to 60 miles per hour. It wasn't exactly fast, but it was one of the fastest roadsters available when it launched, and thanks to its mid-engine layout, it was far more capable than its front-engine contemporaries. Boxster may have only been the baby Porsche, but it was the best roadster money could buy.
I remember, I think I was probably 16, mm-hmm. 15 or 16, and my friend Tig's dad got a Boxster. Nice. And we're like, oh my God, like first person I ever knew that owned a Porsche. And he was like, yeah, you want to go on a ride real quick?
Yeah.
And I was like, hell yeah. So I hopped in, and he went 45, and then did a U-turn after one block and took me back. And I was like, what the f*** is this? That's
hard. Thanks, mister.
Yeah, cool.
This new formula was a massive sales success. It sold 7,000 units in its first year in the U.S., a massive improvement from the 3,000 cars total that Porsche sold in the States just 4 years earlier.
Whoa, that's like
pretty good.
Special edition Corvette numbers.
Yeah. The sales continued to improve as the car improved. And by the end of the first generation, the Boxster could be had with a much more capable 280 horsepower 3.2 liter flat six. Things took a more controversial turn in 1997 with the launch of the 996 generation 911. To this day, it remains perhaps the most divisive 911 of all time. Porsche purists hated that the iconic circular headlights had been swapped to the now infamous fried egg shape. But worst of all, this new 911 was water cooled.
No! I
so, hate when my engines are water cooled.
Let's talk about it. Looking back, abandoning the antiquated air-cooled design was the obvious way forward. And it's kind of crazy to think that all-wheel drive and sequential turbocharging made it into the 911 before a radiator. And though the 996 is a divisive car to this day, the conversation, outside of some diehard purists, ultimately only centers around its looks. The 996 was a sales success, and for a long while served as a great and affordable way into a secondhand 911.
I think it's about to kind of blow up.
Yeah.
A lot, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's going to take the curve's about to shoot.
Yeah.
Because anyone who buys it is kind of like, it rode the wave of, I mean, that's pretty cheap for a Porsche.
Yeah.
It's pretty low miles. I'll get that. And yeah. Then the second you drive it, you're like, holy crap, yeah, this thing's so fun. Yeah. This is, you know, it got shat on for everything you just said. But now once you get in one, it all goes away.
Can you explain to me, like I'm an idiot, why it even really matters?
Well, you see, Joe, the headlights
aren't circles. No, not the headlights, the air-cooled versus water-cooled.
It's much easier to make more power and reliability if it's water cooled. I know there are some people that say, oh, well, you have to worry about gaskets and you have to worry about radiator and pressure, but
that's on the plus side for water cooled. Why are purists so like
it's just because that's a Porsche, I think, is mostly the thing where it's the marvel of being able to do an air cooled engine and get that out of it that was so strongly ingrained in the Porsche identity that the second they switched it just was.
It's like if Subaru stopped doing flat like boxer engines and just started doing like
only V6.
Only Nissan VQ V6s, you know, like yeah. I think like that'd be the same kind of sentiments. Like why the hell are we doing this? Like we had a good thing going here, you know?
Hey, I don't want to make more than 180 horsepower. What are we doing here? Yeah.
I think that's probably it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like it's a cool thing. It's like if they stop making the Fender Telecaster so freaking heavy, you know, that's the whole thing. It's heavy.
Guys, thank you for putting it in Italian terms for me.
Just so you can understand. Yeah.
It's like
Joe can't understand concepts without an accent.
But now I get it. There was an STI, a brand new WRX parked right outside my house. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it because he was like kind of hanging over my driveway a little bit, and I really hate that. The very next day, he was parked there again, but his
pulled
front
out and took
was
the nose
smashed
out.
In.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, no. He had just bought this car and he just smashed it. I was like, damn, that sucks.
Maybe he was doing it to be polite and he smashed in the front end so it didn't go over your driveway.
Let me just shave off a couple inches so I'm not inconveniencing.
I feel really bad for those guys. Just gonna drive real hard into this pylon. There you go, Joe.
The 996 also pushed a financially healthy Porsche into the new millennium and has served as a blueprint for all modern 911s. But not even the watered-down Boxster or the watered-cooled 911 could prepare Porsche fans for what was coming next. With the Boxster's overnight success, Wideking realized that there were entire market segments the brand had neglected that they could not only compete in, but define. Not only could they make affordable roadsters and offend their own purists, they didn't even have to make cars. In the 1990s, SUVs were surging in popularity. Porsche wanted a slice of the pie. Enthusiasts and journalists lost their minds when Porsche announced they were going to make an SUV. They just started to turn their financial situation around, and they had already alienated some of their most devout fans. Nerds. Why risk it all? Why risk it all to develop the antithesis of a sports car, they asked. No one took the challenge or the criticism more seriously than Porsche themselves. This new SUV wasn't going to compete with the Ford Explorer any more than the Boxster did with the Miata. It could look around for inspiration, but this new car, the Cayenne, had to look, feel, and drive like a Porsche. To do that, Porsche spent a lot of money and time developing the chassis and suspension. At the time, most SUVs were truck-like body-on-frame designs. But if Porsche wanted an athletic SUV, this chunky design wasn't going to work. Instead, Porsche drew inspiration from the more car-like Toyota RAV4 and Honda CR-V, which used a unibody construction and would help give the Cayenne more maneuverability. But that was only a piece of the puzzle. Even though Porsche wanted the Cayenne to drive like a car, they wanted it to be perfectly capable off-road, which all but ruled out a pure unibody construction. The result was a sort of hybrid chassis. It was ultimately a unibody, but the floor of the chassis used the same type of ladder construction seen on body-on-frame designs, which enabled it to handle punishing off-road terrain.
I did not know that.
These things are actually like very sought after by off-roaders.
I didn't know.
There's a Eurowise, I think, makes like a suspension like lift kit for these things. Especially the diesel Cayenne, which would come a little bit later. Those things are super. People love these for off-roading.
Yeah.
They're very
good. My dad's
good
friend, his wife has one that has like 400,000 miles on it or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
No kidding. That's crazy. When I was looking to buy my truck, I was looking into the idea of like maybe getting an SUV instead, looking at like BMW X5. They have like pretty good towing capability.
And there's a manual option for that, too, the early ones.
But also the diesel Cayennes, but the market for those are, like, they're going up in value. People want them. So, like, even to get a car with, like, 100,000 miles, you're still paying, like, 30 grand for it. I was like, that's just too much.
Yeah.
On
the other hand, though, you can get, like, a mid-2000s GTS Cayenne for 12, 10, which is, like, very fast.
And if you don't want to pay the Porsche tax, you can also, like, the Audi Q7 and the Volkswagen Tiguan are the same chassis. So,
I didn't know that about the Tiguan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Diesel Tiguan is the same as a diesel Cayenne.
What?
At least that's what I tell myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. not Tiguan. Maybe it's the Touareg.
Tiguan. They're both silly.
It's so stupid, yes.
That, of course you're going to get them confused.
Yeah, what the hell? I thought they were the same car. What did James have?
Yeah, the Tiguan.
Tiguan.
Sorry,
oh, it's the Touareg.
It's the Touareg. It's the larger one, not the Tiguan. Don't kill me, okay?
It's the other Jetstream name.
Yeah. Yeah. The only way for a design this complex and multi-purpose to work was if it could truly manage to be two chassis simultaneously. And the solution was radical.
Radical, dude.
In the end, 10 different types of metal were used. Heavier metals were used low down for off-road toughness and to lower the center of gravity, and lighter metals were used higher up in the frame for agility.
I only do heavy metal.
Yeah, dude.
The roof is just aluminum foil.
Yeah. Porsche then fitted locking center differentials and an adjustable air suspension that could adapt to any situation the driver threw at it. By this point, the engine seemed like the easy part. It was an SUV after all, and would be heavier than Porsche's standard cars. The simplest solution was to dial up the power, and Porsche developed a 4.5-liter V8 to get the job done. The V8 was available in two versions. You had a non-turbo for the Cayenne S and a twin-turbo configuration for the Cayenne Turbo. The naturally aspirated V8 made an impressive 340 horsepower, and the twin-turbo made an incredible 450.
Damn.
Good Lord.
The early
That's
aughts.
Crazy.
When the Cayenne launched in 2003, people were blown away. Common takes at the time amounted to, I want to hate this, but I can't. They were stunned by what it could do off-road and how car-like it felt on the road. It may have been a far cry from the 911, but it was closer to a 911 than an Explorer, and that's what mattered. Nothing like this had ever been done before. and drivers no longer wanted to sacrifice performance for practicality. In that way, the Cayenne seems almost like a natural growth from the 911, which was initially conceived to serve the same purpose.
It is funny that the 911 from our last episode was kind of devised as this like commuter that you can supposedly transport your kids in.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
As long as their butts are like 4 inches wide.
Yeah. Yeah. The Cayenne was a massive sales success. In its first year alone, it sold 12,000 units in the U.S., only 3,000 units less than the 911 and Boxster combined. A year after launch, Porsche expanded the engine lineup to include a 247-horsepower 3.2 VR6 from Volkswagen.
That's what I thought was the original engine, because it was the VR6 engine, and I thought that all Cayennes had that engine, but I guess
only a year later. So yeah. This is in the lower cost base model, which boosted sales even further. It became the best-selling vehicle Porsche made, and it wasn't even close. The sales gap between the Cayenne and the rest of the Porsche lineup only grew over the years, and basically became responsible for bankrolling all of the awesome cars coming out of Stuttgart. Its baby brother, the Macan, came along in 2014, became Porsche's best-selling vehicle in 2016. Today, Porsche SUVs make up 2/3 of Porsche's total sales. I would love to drive a Macan. I haven't got the chance yet.
The new ones look amazing. I really like the new looks.
Oh yeah, those new Macans do look pretty interesting.
The back looks so good, and the front, and the side, and the top.
Ooh, I don't like the EV though.
You don't like the EV one? I didn't realize they made a full EV one. Oh,
because you're a Porsche purist.
It's because I'm a Porsche purist, Bart. No, it's just I don't.
I like the EVs, but the air-cooled EVs.
You got to air-cool the battery.
With the success of the manufacturing overhaul, the Boxster, and their faith in the upcoming Cayenne, Porsche was eager to show it hadn't lost its edge. Upcoming supercars from Ferrari like the Enzo and the SLR from Mercedes put Porsche on notice, and Wideking decided Porsche needed a supercar too. Porsche road car engineers didn't have the time to design something completely from scratch, and they paid a visit to their racing division. There, they pulled a V10 from the never-used LMP2000 race car, which itself was a repurposed...
Hey, what'd I tell you guys about pulling parts out of the stuff?
The engine itself was a repurposed V10 originally designed for Formula One. The engine was adapted for road use by reducing stresses on engine components. This resulted in the red line being lowered from 11,000 to 8,600 RPM, with a total output of 603 horsepower.
Damn.
This was down from the 1,000 horsepower it made in F1 guys, but surprisingly close to the 700 horsepower it made in the LMP2000. A body was then designed around the engine, and what we got was the Carrera GT.
Phew. Yow.
For all of Porsche's money-mindedness and careful approaches to new market segments, the Carrera GT was a rushed gamble. But you would never know it. It had a rare-for-the-time all-carbon fiber body, a 3.5-second 0-60 time, and a top speed of 208 miles an hour. Porsche somehow made 1,300 of these cars, almost 5 times more than the 959. And at $390,000 a pop, they even turned a profit this time. The early 2000s were a golden era for Porsche. Even the maligned 996 had found its audience, and Porsche revived the legendary RS nameplate for the first time since the early 70s with the 2003 GT3 RS. It was basically a back-to-basics track car dialed back just enough for street use, making yet another market segment invented by Porsche in this era. The 911 GT2 and 3 have been staples in the 911 range ever since.
For the longest time, I was like, I want to buy a Porsche before I'm 40. And I was trying to make it happen. And then...
You turned 40.
Are you 40 yet?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
But I don't think... Because you got to, like, know everything about it unless you're paying out the butt to, like, get it serviced at the dealership all the time or whatever. I was like, I don't think I have the knowledge yet. I don't want to, like, let it just rot. I don't want it to break down and then I'm not driving it. So I want to really, like, pick Tristan's brain. Be like, what gen should I get? What should I do regularly and when should I do it?
Should get a Boxster or a Cayman.
I should. I think I would get a Boxster before it came in.
Yeah, it's probably more affordable.
Just because, yeah.
I was going to say, you're not 40 yet. You're so spry. You're pitching still.
Oh, did you see my fat belly in that picture.
I didn't see your fat belly, but I saw you pitching.
I struck someone out this weekend.
Nice.
Dude. Oh, good. That Tommy John surgery is paying off.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a baboon ligament in my arm.
I was watching a lot of baseball videos yesterday and found one about Nolan Ryan, who I'm named after, but I've never really, like...
The one where he caught Pete Rose's ball in front of his face?
No.
That's a really good story. He goes... I was just going to say,
like, the fact that he played until he was 46 years old is, like, insane.
He got hit by a comebacker from Bo Jackson, who is one of the strongest people on earth. And he's just, his nose and mouth are just bleeding, and he's just, like, wiping it.
Oh, yeah.
And he chugged a Budweiser in the dugout and then came back and pitched again. But another really good story is he was facing Pete Rose. I think he was on... Astros at the time, Pete Rose was on Cincinnati Reds, and they're just kind of like, the teams are switching over at some point, and Nolan Ryan was taking batting practice and walked past Pete Rose, and Pete Rose was going like, I wish you'd throw that curveball just one time, and Nolan Ryan was like, why? He goes, so I can f***ing hit it at your head. And the next day, he threw only fastballs to Pete Rose for two at bats, and then the third at bat, Pete Rose is up there. The count is like perfect. I think it's like two strikes, one ball, and Nolan Ryan was like, "This is it. I'm gonna throw my curve," and he threw a perfect curve, and he said that he saw Pete's eyes light up as it was coming to him, and it hit like Nolan was kind of like off balance, and you know he threw and he was kind of like down ducking a little bit. The ball comes like straight at his face and he catches it. It was a comebacker that he caught.
It's pretty good.
And Pete Rose, like.
I mean, Pete Rose was amazing at gambling.
We don't need to include this, but I love Nolan Ryan.
This is baseball. I'm not here for baseball.
There's no cars in baseball.
If the 2000s were an era of frontiers for Porsche, the 2010s symbolized a return to their roots. In 2012, Porsche was sold to its longtime partner, Volkswagen, for whom their founder, Ferdinand Porsche, had designed their first car, which Ferry then borrowed parts from to make the first Porsche badge car. If Ferdinand Porsche could see the company today, he would likely be over the moon with what Porsche has become. If you listen to episode 1, you know that Ferdinand was obsessed with electricity as a kid and worked in electricity before getting involved with cars. The first car he ever designed was actually electric. And a few years later, he made the world's first gas-electric hybrid vehicle before going on to make some of the most advanced race cars of his time. It was a full-circle moment in 2014 when Porsche launched a hybrid hypercar called the 918. As with all big changes Porsche had made over the years, from making the 911 water-cooled to designing an SUV, the 918 had its share of detractors. But hybrid supercars today are practically the standard, and Porsche was again ahead of the curve. A year later, in 2015, Porsche unveiled the Taycan, a battery-electric four-door which has converted even the staunchest anti-EV enthusiasts. It's odd to say a full EV harkens back to the first car ever made by Porsche, but it literally does.
Harkens it does.
Harkens it does. I say it every time we mention the Taycan, but a Taycan Sport Turismo wagon, I want one. For all of Porsche's impressive innovations and radical changes, Porsche very much remains a car manufacturer that feels grounded in tradition. When you innovate as much as Porsche has, innovation itself becomes part of the brand. But roots and design heritage are very much on display. The 911, in essence and in its appearance, is the same car it was when it launched 60 years ago, albeit a bit faster.
And a bit fatter, too.
It's got a talking big numbers.
Yeah.
But the history of Porsche is more than circular headlights and rear engine layout. It's one of near perfection in everything they've tried, never being satisfied and pushing their brand and the industry in places no one else believes they can go. It's easy to see Porsche as a conservative company, but in reality, they are progressive, and they've never been afraid to take a gamble. They've launched car after car that sought to invent or dominate a segment and have released a number of controversial cars, all to success. In an era of uncertainty, if you want to know where the auto industry is headed, there's no safer bet than looking. A Porsche. Wow. That's the story of Porsche, everybody. That was a lot, dude. I feel like my brain is now stuffed.
Yeah, you did great.
It's filled with Stuttgart.
Yeah. So.
You're full of Stuttgart.
You're so full of Stuttgart.
If you could be gifted one Porsche from any era, what would it be? What would be the color? What would be the spec?
Man, good question.
There's too many to choose from.
I think a really like a black 993, sick.
Yeah.
A silver 930 would be amazing. Turbo 930 would be sick.
I
want a car that is scary to drive. I want to build my goal next year here at Donut. I want
take out a life insurance policy.
We could all take out life insurance on him.
On Nolan.
Yeah.
I want to build a car that is really scary to drive.
So the Mustang is not, like the high Mustang is not scary to drive?
No.
Really?
No. I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe if the ground is wet and you're on the slicks, yeah, it'd be a little dicey. But I want something where it's like you breathe on the gas pedal and you're like spinning the tires.
Yeah. I think, you know, dream car would be Carrera GT, like that blue. Remember that Gimbala blue one that crashed?
Mm-hmm.
That's like, I love that car. I think a GT2 RS is probably a more... That'd reasonable choice.
Yeah,
it's funny to say that, but
yeah, more reasonable than that, maybe, yeah. But
that's my choice.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. Next week, episode 300, we are doing a very special story on that one.
It's a little car adjacent, but
definitely car adjacent. But I'm very excited to tell it, and we're gonna do that. So follow Bart at BidsBardo on social media. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber.
Do it.
Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes if you'd like. Thanks to our crew. We got Audrey Holden and Edgar Grajeda behind the camera. They're always doing a great, great job.
Thanks to Audrey for writing this three-part series, too. That was really fun.
That's a lot of Porsche knowledge, Audrey. What's up? Two books. Okay.
One of the books was like this then.
It was all pictures.
All right. We'll see you next time, guys.
Bye.